Find out you're part owner of a house on Martha's Vineyard? You could suck the joy out of a lollipop. Mimi left the room. More doors and cabinets opened and closed. A moment later, she was back. Coat closet. She held up a dusty bottle of Smirnoff. Why didn't I think to look there first? She glanced at Ginger. Your face looks like chalk. Are you okay?
I'm fine, Ginger lied, because no one wanted to hear the truth, that she felt unwell.
Unwell and wobbly and out of body at the thought that Glory had wanted to own that house.
How did she afford to buy it? Mimi asked.
Then she remembered. Oh, the life insurance. Remember that? First time Mom ever gave Dad a compliment when she found out there was life insurance? Of course, by then, he was too dead to hear it.
It was odd how often this happened, Ginger and Mimi retaining different slivers of family memory. It was almost as if the recollections had been split down the middle and doled out. You get this, I get that, so no one would be privy to it all.
Ginger glanced over and saw Callie washing her mug with great purpose.
Callie felt her staring. I'm going back to the vineyard in the morning.
She began to dry the mug, rubbing so hard it looked to Ginger like she was trying to remove the glaze.
Back? Ginger asked. Is that where you live? Is that where you've been?
The mug was finally dry. Callie sat down.
If you want to come with me, you'll have to get here early. I'm leaving first thing.
Bottoms up. Mimi poured herself a shot and drank it. Tomorrow won't work. She poured another shot and offered it to Ginger, who declined. Too much to organize. Plus, Gingy should really wait around here for a couple of days. She leaned toward Callie and whispered, Has she told you about her situation? She mouthed the next.
Julia.
And then stretched out her mouth in a grimace.
She can't go, right? I could go, Ginger cut her off, if I wanted to. But I don't. I don't want anything to do with that house.
Callie nodded.
That's okay. Mom made provisions for what to do if the originals can't agree.
What do you mean, originals? Ginger asked.
What do you mean, provisions? Mimi asked louder. The originals is the four of us. I mean, the three of us.
Callie corrected herself.
Me, you, and Mimi. The provision is, if we can't agree, we have to donate the house to the land bank. The lawyer has the papers. Donation isn't what Mom wanted. She didn't think you'd want it either.
Are you listening, Gingy? Mimi said. If we can't agree, we're supposed to donate the house to some bank. So pull it together. Your mother's dying wish is for us to go to the house one last time to toss her ashes. Are you going to ignore your mother's last wish?
Satisfying her dead mother's wish was not something Ginger cared about. But she did care about Callie.
Callie, who was sitting across from her now, finally, after all these years back home.
Ginger did not want Callie to leave again. You want us to come to the vineyard to do this?
Yes.
Okay, we will.
What a relief. Callie smiled, and there it was, the feature that had been hiding, the big smile of the cutest tangle. While Mimi shot back another drink, Ginger called the funeral home to change the arrangements. The funeral home manager was like a petulant child.
Don't you want Mommy to be treated with respect?
But Ginger stood her ground.
They'll keep her for tonight, she reported when she was done. In the morning, we'll have to stop over and sign a release. Then we have to go to the Cremation Society to sign papers there. The Cremation Society will arrange to pick her up.
Her phone chimed. A text. She hurried out of the room, reading as she walked. It was Richard.
I'm home, waiting for you. Where are you?
Richard had stopped texting months ago, after he realized that even though Ginger knew Julia did not have a phone,
She still got excited every time she got a text. Excited and then disappointed. He must be worried to have broken his own rule. She quickly typed back, "I'm with Mimi and Callie. Be there soon." She returned to the kitchen and told her sisters, "I have to go home. Do you want to come with me, Callie? Spend the night?" "Thank you, but I'd prefer to stay here." "You should come," Ginger said. "It'll be more comfortable." Then she saw it, the slight motion of her sister shrinking back, as if to avoid being crushed. Was that what Ginger did? Make people feel in danger of getting crushed? "Never mind. If you want to stay here, that's fine. Mimi and I will swing by in the morning. We'll come early. We can figure out the rest after we all get a good night's sleep." She hurried off before she could make the mistake of pressing her sister again. Chapter 25. On the day the new people moved in, Glory made the announcement that she was going back to work as a personal shopper at her old store, the place where she worked when she was first married. "Part-time," she explained as she portioned out the Coca-Cola chicken. White meat for Solly and Ginger, thigh for Mimi, drumstick for Callie, wings for herself.
"Part-time is better than no time," Solly said, going along. They rarely fought anymore because now Solly just went along.
"The man who runs the department, Mr. Freeze, says there's a good chance they'll need me full-time by the holidays."
Glory crossed her fingers.
"Let's hope."
Solly crossed his fingers, too. But Ginger didn't think he looked like he had any hope at all. After dinner, they moved to the den to watch TV. Tonight, it was Laugh-In. As usual, minutes after the show began, they all heard the gaspy snore that signaled Solly had fallen asleep in his chair. Glory got up and beckoned for Ginger to follow her to the kitchen.
"I've got news," she said when they were alone. "Great news. You're going to be a mother's helper after all."
For a second, Ginger allowed herself the thought that a miracle had occurred, that the new people were gone and Evelyn was back with Thomas, who needed more watching than ever. Glory put an end to her reverie.
"I mean, for me. What do you say to being a mother's helper for your own mother? Is that a good idea or what?"
Ginger concentrated hard on putting feeling in her eyes, specifically the feeling that this was the best news ever in the history of the world.
"It's a great idea. You're my peach, you know that. Now, you're going to have to keep a very close eye on Mimi. I swear that girl lives to get into trouble. But she only does it for attention, so you have to try and ignore her, okay?"
Ginger had no clue how that was supposed to work, keeping a close eye on Mimi while also ignoring her. But she wanted to stay a peach, so she nodded as if the task was clear.
"Callie is another story. With her, you're going to have to be patient. She's going through a phase."
"What kind of phase?"
"A phase is a phase. What more can I say?"
She sat down and motioned for Ginger to sit beside her. There were 5 chairs around the table now. Ginger didn't know where the 6th one went. It disappeared one night while she was sleeping. And in the morning, when the sisters paused to figure out where to sit in the new configuration, Glory blurted out,
"Enough with the assigned seats. Loosen up. Anything goes."
"We're in this together, kiddo," Glory told her now. "You and me."
She laid her cool palm atop Ginger's hand, but only for a brief moment. Her tone changed to all business.
"Okay, Pinocchio. We got to get our stories straight. If Callie doesn't feel like talking and someone asks what's wrong with her, what do you say?"
Ginger took a chance.
"It's just a phase?"
She could see that was wrong.
"I mean, I'll say nothing."
This time her mother cocked her head slightly, so Ginger knew she was on the right track.
"I'll say nothing's wrong with Callie,
What's wrong with you?
Ginger laughed so hard it woke up Solly, who rushed into the kitchen to find out what was wrong.
What do you mean, wrong? Everything's great. It's a new day, Solly. Changes in the air.
She stood up.
Now, if you two will excuse me, I've got a theater group meeting to get to.
She made a slow exit, and when she was gone, the room filled up with a familiar smell. Change might be in the air outside, but inside it was still onions. Mr. Freeze's prediction came true. By early December, Glory was hired full-time. By the end of January, she was named Personal Shopper of the Week, a title she held on to for months. This incarnation of her mother, the Glory who spent all day fussing over strangers, was a huge improvement over the previous one, the Glory who stayed in bed, or the one before that, the Glory who picked fights with Solly. Most nights now, the family ate together in peace. Instead of Glory berating Solly for telling stories about his dull day, she regaled them with tales of her day. How she'd eased customers into sweater sets and mini skirts they swore they had no interest in trying on. How she won them over with compliments. Easy to do, she explained, because she paid attention to what they said and what they wanted.
Audrey Hepburn would kill to have your bust, she'd tell one, and to another she'd say, You sure you're not Julie Christie's younger sister?
To win over her colleagues, she proposed department competitions. And when Mr. Freeze put her in charge of picking out prizes, she was careful not to win all the time.
Sometimes it's better to let someone else win, she confessed to her family over dinner. People get very put out if I win 3 months in a row.
But when she did, a handbag or cardigan for herself, a hat or cashmere socks for Solly, the girls did well too. One or the other finding a surprise, either boxed or wrapped in tissue paper on her pillow. A wool kilt, an argyle vest, a pair of white lace-up boots lined with fake fur. There were occasional complaints. The other personal shoppers were cliquey. They didn't always appreciate her advice. They begrudged her talent for closing a sale.
What do they want me to do when someone requests me? Should I tell the customer no?
For Ginger, listening to a little belly aching was a small price to pay for the freedom that came with Glory's job. Now, between her mother's work and her theater group, she was hardly ever home. But her father did not seem pleased.
Again you're going out. For one night, you can't stay in?
Wake up, Solly. The old days are over and good riddance to them. You know what Gloria Steinem says?
Gloria Steinem had replaced Ivan the director as the most quoted person at the table.
American children suffer from too much mother and not enough father.
Ginger thought if her father had a choice, he'd bring back fortune cookie Ivan from the dead rather than listen to fortune cookie Gloria Steinem. But he didn't have a choice about this, or about anything. As far as she could tell, the amount of unhappiness in the house remained unchanged. It was just distributed differently. Glory bustled about practically beaming with delight, while Solly napped or simmered in his chair. The reason for his bad mood, according to her mother, was the toy business was in a slump. But since the slump seemed to have hit Solly's business alone, Ginger came up with another theory. The problem, as she saw it, was her father had stopped selling what he called dumb toys. Dumb toys, she figured out, was code for any toy meant for a boy. Her father simply could no longer bear to be around matchbox superfast car sets, power play tabletop hockey, moon missile kits, or skittle pool. If her mother had been paying attention, if she was at least around, she might have pointed out these toys were not just for boys. Girls like to play skittle pool and to build moon missiles. Look at Callie. She still liked lining up her stuffed animals and pretending to feed them.
but she'd added the matchbox cars she'd inherited from her brother into her make-believe games, giving her stuffed dogs lifts across the room to visit each other. Ginger now had to constantly leap up and kick the cars under the bed when she heard her father's footsteps in the hall. Callie remained oblivious, but Ginger knew if Solly saw those cars, he'd scoop them up and throw them out, and no amount of moping would bring them back. But Glory was not around much, and when she was around, she preferred the conversation to be about things like how few women looked good in harem pants. Callie started wandering that spring. So while Solly was at work not selling dumb toys, and Glory was convincing mothers of the bride not to be afraid of wearing color, Ginger spent her afternoons walking the neighborhood searching for her sister. She quickly learned Callie's favorite hiding places, neighbors' yards, particularly those fenced in for dogs. Mrs. Budney was the first to complain.
"Yesterday your sister rang my bell," she told Ginger one afternoon. "Wanted to walk my dog. I told her my dog died 6 months ago. Today she came back and asked if she could walk my cat. I don't have a cat. Is your mother home?"
"I'm sure she didn't mean to bother you," Ginger said. She didn't admit that hearing this was good news. At home, Callie had gone back to giving everyone the silent treatment. Bothering neighbors meant at least she was talking to someone. But Ginger knew enough to apologize. "I'm really sorry. My mom is at work. But if you want, you can come back tonight." She didn't expect Mrs. Budney to take her up on the suggestion, but that night, right before dinner, she glanced out the window and saw their neighbor coming up the front walk.
"For God's sake," Glory said after Ginger filled her in. "All right, what's done is done. Get that guilty look off your face. That's not going to help things."
Ginger tried her best to get the guilt off her face.
"That's worse. Try looking blank. Can you make yourself go blank?"
Glory demonstrated a blank face, which seemed to make her soften.
"It's going to be okay, kiddo. We can handle this."
They were collaborators now.
"You've got to learn a little, that's all. So, watch and listen.
Listening is key."
She brushed the creases out of her camel-colored skirt and opened the door right as Mrs. Budney was about to ring the bell. This seemed to unnerve the woman, and Ginger wondered if that was the point.
"Mrs. Budney!"
Glory sang out.
"It's been too long."
And there it was, the change in her face. Her frown lines gone and her internal light. It really was as if she had a light inside, switched to bright.
"Come in, come in. How have you been?"
"Very well, thank you."
Mrs. Budney didn't ask how Glory was. Ginger had noticed this, that people no longer asked her mother how she was.
"I don't want to be a bother."
"Bother? What bother? Come in, have some tea."
"No, thank you. I'm here about your daughter."
Her eyes flitted to Ginger.
"The young one."
She went on to recount how Callie asked to walk her dead dog and her non-existent cat.
"Oh, dear."
Glory's frown line pulsed back and then vanished.
"Sounds disturbing."
"It was."
Mrs. Budney lifted her chin, and Ginger watched as her mother, noticing the movement, echoed it, chin rising to the same angle.
"I know what loss feels like," Glory said. "And it doesn't matter what kind. Loss is loss. You loved that dog. You and your husband walked him all the time."
Glory noticed a slight change in Mrs. Budney's face and corrected herself.
"Of course you were the main walker."
Mrs. Budney nodded. Glory nodded too. She went on to ask how long they'd had the dog and how old the dog was when he died. And when Mrs. Budney described how the dog's arthritis affected his gait, Glory rubbed her own hand as if she could feel the dead dog's pain in her fingers. Before long, they were at the kitchen table sipping the tea the neighbor hadn't wanted. And by the end of the dazzling performance, Mrs. Budney was considering a proposal that they chip in and get a dog together.
"Would that be insane?"
Glory asked, laughing at her own idea. Two neighbors sharing a dog. Joint custody? Obviously, Callie would take care of the dog after school. She really wants a dog. But during the day, I'm not home. That's why we can't get a dog. She paused. Ever since last summer. She cast her eyes to her lap. I work now.
I'll take care of it during school, Mrs. Budney volunteered. I don't work.
The next thing Ginger knew, the two women were making plans to go to Connecticut to visit a beagle breeder who Glory said got first place at the Westminster Dog Show 2 years in a row.
Ever watch that? She asked Mrs. Budney. I try and watch every year.
As soon as Mrs. Budney left, a trail of cookie crumbs marking her path to the door, Ginger asked when the dog show was on.
I've never seen it. Can I watch it with you sometime? Or is it on when I'm at school?
What are you talking about? How do I know when it's on? Anyway, I don't have time to discuss dogs. I've got to make a fruit basket for that Badinsky before she starts bad-mouthing your sister up and down the block.
Fruit baskets were one of Glory's solutions for handling prickly people. She modeled them after baskets she saw in catalogs, but hers had lots of crumpled tissue paper on the bottom so they looked abundant, even when there were only a few pieces of fruit. Mrs. Budney and Glory never did go on a trip to see the breeder in Connecticut or anywhere else. But Ginger did have to take Callie over to deliver a fruit basket and apologize. And when they returned from their mission, Ginger got a stern lecture about keeping Callie in sight after school from now on. Keeping Callie in sight at all times was a challenge. She seemed allergic to staying inside. When Mimi offered to share the job of bodyguard, Ginger accepted. It made sense, four eyes being better than two. It didn't take long for her to realize what a mistake that was. Adding Mimi's eyes only made things worse. Mimi had all kinds of ideas that didn't work out well. There was the misguided walk to town, which ended with them all getting kicked out of Woolworth's for making a mess of the puzzle department. And after that, the failed attempt at keeping Callie happy by showing her how to climb the oak tree in the front lawn outside their house.
You'll get a great view of the whole neighborhood, Mimi had promised her.
That it turned out Callie's ankle was strained but not broken made little difference to Glory.
"You're letting me down, Gingy," she said after calling her into her room. "I thought you were responsible. Was I wrong?"
"No," Ginger debated how much blame to give to Mimi. "It's just Callie won't listen. She barely talks." She could read in her mother's face that this had been a mistake to say. Before she could take it back, Mimi ran in to join their discussion.
"I know what the problem is," she said. "The reason Callie doesn't like to talk is because of what she saw, right?"
Glory cocked her head.
"What did she see?"
"I don't know."
Mimi looked like she was regretting what she said.
"She saw what she shouldn't have seen."
She started to back out of the room, but Glory blocked her.
"What are you talking about?"
Mimi surrendered.
"It's about what she saw last summer, when she was with you and Charlie, at the hospital."
She shrugged.
"That's what people say." "Which people?"
Glory sounded more curious than angry.
"My teacher, the lady down the block, the mailman, everyone. Don't know what she saw, but whatever it was, she shouldn't have seen it." "Was that it? What did she see?"
The color seeped out of Glory's face.
"I never should have taken her to that horror show of a hospital."
She sat on her bed and seemed to deflate.
"You can't imagine."
Ginger and Mimi sat down on either side of her and leaned in to buck her up.
"If I told you what happened, you wouldn't believe me."
"I would believe you," Ginger volunteered. "I always believe you."
By which she meant she always tried. Her mother shook her head.
"No, I'm not supposed to think about that."
Her spine straightened and her eyes came back to life. and neither are you. Next time someone asks you what happened, or they want to know what's wrong with your little sister, don't respond. Put your fingers in your ears if you have to.
She plugged her ears.
You can even hum.
She hummed and tried to look light-hearted. Then she dropped her arms, got up, took her brush out of the drawer, and started counting.
1, 2, 3, 4.
She slowly ran the bristles through her hair.
You know the best way to get your hair shiny, right? Brush 100 times. 100 times a day.
The girls nodded.
About that other thing, forget it. That's the best idea. Just forget it. I've already forgotten it. Remind me why you're here?
Sorry, Ginger said.
And she and Mimi fled to the uneasy sanctuary of their room. Chapter 26. Richard followed her up the stairs.
Her room's a mess, Ginger warned him. I want to get it ready.
For what? Julia's not coming home for the funeral.
It's a scattering, she reminded him. And we don't know that for sure. I didn't think Callie would ever come home, and now here she is.
They stopped in front of Julia's door. She'd shut the door months ago when she realized no matter how hard she tried, she couldn't help but look in every time she passed by. Richard opened the door and peered into the chaos.
Her rug is soaked.
He stepped inside, careful not to trample the minefield of clothes, which lay on the floor exactly where Julia had dropped them. He shut the windows.
Why are these open?
Ginger didn't share the reason. That the windows had been open since the day Julia left. Since that night, when Ginger got out of bed at 3, or maybe it was 4 in the morning, and without intention walked into Julia's room, climbed into Julia's bed, lifted up the comforter and pulled it over her head, breathing in the scent of her daughter's raspberry herbal essence shampoo. She didn't tell him then, and she didn't tell him now, how the smell of the bedclothes had made her jump, how she'd pushed off the blanket and leapt out, how she'd raced to open those very windows, first one and then the other, taking in deep open-mouthed breaths, trying as hard as she could, and for reasons she still could not explain, to get her daughter's smell out of her nose. That night, when Richard woke up, he thought it was the sound of water filling the bathtub that disturbed his sleep. Not the sound of windows opening and of Julia's track medals hanging on ribbons from curtain rods clanging together like broken glass. When he found Ginger that night, standing in the bathtub filled with water, still wearing a robe, he'd asked if she was all right. The question seemed so ridiculous she didn't bother answering. Wasn't it clear she was not all right? He'd struggled for a moment, trying to figure out what was called for. Then he rolled up his pajama bottoms, stepped into the tub, and embraced her. That was Richard. In the end, he always did the right thing. He got in the tub and embraced her. But he rolled up his pajama bottoms first. As far as she could tell, in the weeks that followed Julia's departure, he hadn't lost a moment's sleep. Ginger brought in a stack of bath towels from the linen cabinet and they got to work, laying the towels on the soaking carpet. Her glance flicked to the metal still hanging from the curtain rod, to the collage on the wall beside the bed, superhero women in poses of power, to the clock radio that flashed the wrong time, collateral damage from a recent storm, and to the photograph of Julia on her desk. She looks so happy, Ginger thought. And then, with a start, realized who'd taken that picture. That the rapturous smile on her daughter's face was there because she was looking at Nick. Richard spread out the last of the towels, and when he was done, he put his hand on top of hers. Together, they pressed down, tamping hard to absorb the moisture. When the towels were soaked, they gathered them up and dumped them in the tub. Then they went to their room and undressed without speaking. Silently slipping under the blanket,
They curled toward each other, tender and gentle, two twisted spoons, moving together at the same moment to make love. In the morning, there was the usual moment of confusion, followed by dread. Something happened. What? She opened her eyes and took inventory. Julia was gone. Glory was dead. Kelly was back. Someone was breathing into her neck. Richard.
You okay?
He pulled her closer. She nodded and he slipped out of bed. The day proceeded, dreamlike. She made the necessary calls. First to her friend, Cheryl, who agreed to sub for her. Then to the principal to let him know her mother had died and she needed time off. Richard made breakfast, eggs perfectly poached. While they ate, he offered to stay with her. He could get someone to cover for him at work. Ginger told him no. You should go in. You might want to save your favors in case you want to come for the scattering.
Of course I'm going to come.
Their goodbye was tender, but promised nothing. When Ginger and Mimi got to Glory's house to pick up Callie, they found she'd already left. A note on the kitchen table told them she was taking the noon ferry out of Woods Hole. Another note gave them her cell number and the address of the Vineyard house, in case they forgot. Mimi was mad.
It's not right. She swoops in, tells us what to do, and then leaves the mess for us to clean up.
She tried Callie's cell to vent. When Callie didn't answer, Ginger felt relieved. Having Mimi yell at Callie would not make anything better.
We don't have that much to do, Ginger said. The main thing is we'll be together for the scattering. That's what's important, right? The three of us together?
What's important is selling the house. I Googled last night. Real estate there is crazy. I wish I could remember more about the place. Distance from water is everything.
She left serial messages on Kelly's voicemail.
How far is the house from water? Does it have a deck or porch? Is there a view from the roof?
But Kelly did not pick up. At the bank, Mimi signed to gain entry to Glory's safety deposit box without mentioning her mother had
died. Easier this way.
She whispered to Ginger, who'd had no clue Mimi had become co-signer for Glory's accounts right before the move to the Meadows. Now they huddled in a small privacy booth and examined the loot. 6 silver Kennedy half dollars in a beaded change purse. The financial news didn't improve when they learned the balance of the savings account.
$50 in change,
Mimi muttered as she drove to the Cremation Society. Ginger concentrated on ignoring both Mimi's disappointment in Glory's bank book and her obsession with the prospect of selling their surprise inheritance home. She knew anything she said might start Mimi on her usual tirade about the impossibly high cost of private schools for 3 kids, or the exorbitant price of sleepaway camp these days, or the fast-approaching combined total of 3 college tuitions. By now, Ginger knew, almost to the dollar, the outrageous cost of upkeep on their pool, the fees at their tennis club, the yearly total of the not-so-secret support she and Neil gave to multiple Popkins in various degrees of need. She stayed silent as they drove, letting the questions Mimi shouted into Kelly's voicemail turn into a hum.
Hum. Is the road paved or is it dirt?
Hum.
Are the toilets regular or compost? Hum. Are the homes of the nearest neighbors within view?
At the Cremation Society, Ginger signed the authorization form while Mimi grumbled her way through the urn catalog. After much deliberation, she settled on a faux clamshell that the cremation staffer, worn down by Mimi's inquiries as to durability versus dissolvability, concurred was the most perfect of all the urns. The definite best choice for a scattering at sea. The same staffer then broke the news that it would take 3 days for the filled urn to be returned to them. When Mimi balked, the woman interrupted her.
Okay, we'll aim for 2.
At the end of the day, When Mimi wondered aloud whether they should both wait for the urn, or whether one of them should go ahead to join Callie, Ginger quickly volunteered to go. Driving alone to Woods Hole seemed a far better choice than spending 4 hours in a car with a put-upon Mimi.
"It makes sense for me to go ahead," Ginger told her, and Mimi seemed happy to agree.
The next day, when Ginger reached the ferry terminal, she found a chaotic scene. One of the ferry slips was closed for construction. 2 ferries had been canceled due to mechanical problems, and the next boat due in had been delayed by fog. Because now there wouldn't be room for all the cars that had reservations, Ginger followed directions and parked at a satellite lot, and then called Callie to let her know she was going on the boat as a walk-on. This time, Callie picked up her phone and promised to meet her on the other side. It was only as Ginger reached the gangplank that she realized how much she did not want to go on board. She did not like to travel over water, and she did not want to step on the sandy shore on the other side. But of course, she got on anyway, because that's what was called for, and Ginger always did what was called for. The boat was crowded, and by the time she boarded, there were no more seats. She found a space against a wall in the lower cabin and turned away from the window so she wouldn't see the water. As the ferry began its slow departure from the dock, her knees buckled slightly. She pinched her ear hard so she wouldn't faint.
"Poor thing," the woman standing next to her looked concerned. "The color just drained from your face. You want a Dramamine? I can ask the purser if he's got a Dramamine. Or you can try going up a deck. Higher you go, better you'll feel."
Ginger thanked her and headed for the stairs. But the next deck had the snack bar and reeked of soggy hamburger rolls and scorched soup. The sea got choppy, and the snack bar staff began to put away anything that could slide. But passengers at the tables still popped open Tupperware containers filled with pungent food from home. If Ginger stood there, she would surely get sick. She hurried to a narrow stairway leading to the upper deck. She didn't realize till she reached the top step that this deck was outside, everywhere open to the sea. The wind howled, sending her hair snapping over her face. Someone called, "Mom?" Sweeping her hair away from her eyes, Ginger whipped around and saw a girl. Tall, gangly, long hair, same age as Julia, same kind of t-shirt, cutoffs, worn-out sneakers. But she wasn't Julia. Behind the girl, a woman, her mother, called to her with a sharp, "What?"
"Never mind," the girl said,
and they both disappeared down the stairs. It happened several times a week now. Ginger saw Julia and then realized she was wrong. Sometimes these girls looked like Julia, but just as often they didn't. Apparently, looking like Julia wasn't necessary. As long as there was some tiny similarity, her brain would make the leap. So, if out of the corner of her eye she saw a girl with hair that was long and wavy but not dark red, she'd still think Julia. And if the girl had dark red hair cut into a matronly bob, Julia. Recently, a tall girl in a puffy orange vest turned around and Ginger thought, "Julia," until she realized this Julia was a man. The first few times it happened, she would calm herself by listing the differences. Too tall, thin hair, wrong color eyes, brown skin. But that reminded her of how Glory used to sort people.
Heart-shaped face, fairy broom eyelashes, Shirley Temple dimples.
So she stopped. The habit was hard to break.
"Too many freckles," she thought now.
As the wind whipped up, Ginger slipped on the rain slicker she'd brought along in case the weather turned foul. She pulled the hood up over her head, but a strong gust, like a practical joker, pulled it back down. Around her, the few remaining passengers, tired of having their bodies battered by the sudden gale, retreated indoors. Crab-like, she moved, one hand over the other, down the narrow steps. Back inside, the flat-screen TVs on opposite walls played on.
Cafe smells hung heavy in the air. Greasy fries, a Tupperware of curry, the burnt clam bits at the bottom of the chowder pot. Ginger found the bathroom and got sick as quietly as she could. When she was finished cleaning her face, she cleaned the sink and then wiped the mirror with a paper towel, because she'd noticed spots that might or might not have been from her. She returned to her place at the wall as the chains clanged, the ropes got tossed, the boat bumped into the dock. Still feeling unsteady, she slowly rolled her bag down the ramp and blinked in the sudden and surprising sun. There they were, Callie and Echo, standing against the primary colors of a perfect vineyard day.
"What a trip," she reported. "Terrible traffic to Woods Hole. Two ferries were canceled. The water was so choppy they shut down the snack bar."
"It's sunny here," Callie said. "I'm parked a few blocks away." Echo tugged at his leash.
"Okay," Callie told him. "Let's go."
She set off at a slow jog. Ginger, hurrying alongside, struggled to keep up as she pulled her luggage along behind her. When they got into the car, Echo jumped into the front seat, but Callie made a quick gesture so he moved to the back. Minutes later, they were out of town, tourist shops replaced by a landscape of rolling hills and stone walls.
"I need to make a quick stop."
The car lurched as Callie turned down a dirt road. Ginger caught a glimpse of a sign, the word "parking" carved into wood, letters painted red. Her stomach dipped.
"Here?"
Callie nodded as she pulled into a spot and turned off the car.
"Echo can't come with me. Dogs aren't allowed on Charlie's Beach. Will you stay with him?"
Charlie's Beach.
"Where are you going?"
Callie got out, slammed the door, and leaned through the open window.
"It's not far to the shortcut. I'm a fast runner." "Shortcut to where?"
Callie commanded Echo to lie down and then motioned for him to stay, and the dog obeyed.
"I won't be long."
"Wait!" Ginger called out. But her sister had taken off at a sprint and was gone. She sat for a moment, unsure of what to do. When her phone rang, she quickly checked to see who it was. Richard.
"Hey, everything all right?"
The line was thick with static. She had to strain to listen as Richard explained that Julia had just called his cell.
"She's okay," he quickly added. "Anne-Marie tracked her down and told her about Glory. She's sad, but she's okay."
Ginger let out a soft noise. Of course this was good news. It was a relief to know Julia was okay. That was the important part. Not that it was her father who she'd chosen to call.
"Did she cry? Is she coming for the scattering?"
"Didn't cry, isn't coming."
"Okay."
Ginger took this in.
"What did she say when you told her Callie was here?"
"I didn't."
"Why not? You should have. You need to. She'll come home if she knows Callie's here. I'm sure of it. You have to call her back and tell her."
"Gingy, no. She doesn't want me to call back. She told me she borrowed some random person's phone. Look, this is hard for both of us. But you should know Julia told me she's grateful we sent her the message through Nick's mom. We're doing the right thing."
How had Ginger come to be surrounded by so many people who thought there was a right thing? She had no idea. Something nagged at her.
"Then why did she call? Did something happen? Is she sick? She's not pregnant, is she?"
Richard groaned into the phone.
"She called because she's worried."
The phone started to break up.
"You."
"Me? What about me?"
"She's worried about you. She called to make sure you're okay."
The line went dead. Ginger put down her phone. Echo sprung up and nuzzled her neck. She turned and petted the dog. And as she did, she said out loud,
"I have to find a way to make this right. For Julia and for me."
Chapter 27. By the time they approached the second anniversary of the accident, this would be the last year Ginger kept track of time that way. Glory was working 6 days a week and had a loyal customer base of well-heeled women who refused to let any other personal shopper help them. This left Solly, his work hours shrinking, to field the calls from school. Callie's wandering had taken a turn for the worse when she made the discovery that the front door of her school was open and unattended all day long. This meant she could leave whenever she liked. Through a combination of geography and luck, the first time it happened, Ginger caught her. The geography was that Callie's school was at one end of the same long block as Ginger's. The luck was that Ginger was in Earth Science, where gazing out the window was normal, when she saw her sister Callie skipping by. Feigning a bathroom emergency, Ginger left through the rear classroom door and kept going, right out the side exit of the building. She caught up with her sister a block away. When she explained to Callie that she had to stay in school all day like everyone else, her sister didn't protest. And when she returned to her third-grade classroom, her teacher seemed relieved. As for Earth Science, Mr. Michaels, droning on about the cooling of magma when she walked out of his class, had only progressed to droning on about the solidification of magma when she returned, and his granite face showed no sign that he found her extended bathroom break concerning. Both assessments, however, that the third-grade teacher was relieved and that Mr. Michaels hadn't noticed she was missing for most of his class, were wrong. Mr. Michaels was livid, and beneath the third-grade teacher's facade of relief was rage. Solly was mad as well.
Two principals I gotta see because Kelly went to get fresh air.
To help smooth things over with the principals, Glory brought each one an extra-large fruit basket with cherries and chocolate bars hidden among the apples and pears. It seemed to do the trick. But the next time they got called for Callie leaving in the middle of the day, the mandatory meeting was with Miss Mackerel, a guidance counselor who did not succumb to Glory's charms.
"School's a lunatic asylum," Glory said when they got home. "That Miss Mackerel looks like a prison guard. That's where she should work, jail."
"The school is jail," Solly piped up. "The problem is they don't give Callie what's interesting to do. No wonder she wants to fly the coop. If I went there, I'd fly the coop, too."
"You know what, Solly? You're right."
Glory unbuttoned her most recent prize, a Kelly green raincoat.
"Actions speak louder than words. I don't know why I didn't think of it sooner."
"Think of what?"
He sounded a little alarmed.
"A fresh start. That's all she needs, a new school. You know, I read you can enroll your child in any public school you want, long as you pay tuition, which we can, now that I'm working."
"I don't know. How much is tuition?"
Glory didn't answer. She was busy flipping through the yellow pages, writing down the names and numbers of all the elementary schools in the surrounding towns.
"One of these schools is going to be a lucky duck getting Callie as a student in the fall."
For several nights at the kitchen table with a calculator, Solly worked out that in order to pay tuition, he would need to supplement their income. So he started taking on odd jobs on the weekends. Now they never knew where he might pop up. One day he was across the street, mowing a lawn. Another day there he was, bulbous shoes balancing on the rungs of a ladder as he cleaned out muck from the gutter of a house around the block. One Sunday, on a trip to the mall, Glory pulled into an Exxon station, called to the attendant to check her oil, and there he was, Solly sticking his head next to her window, saying,
"What, no hello?"
Now, along with the smell of onions, her father carried with him the faint odor of gasoline. It was the doctor who suggested her father get a hobby to unwind in his spare time, but the one Solly picked wasn't like the projects other fathers did. It wasn't replacing rotted fence pickets or battling the crawl of ivy that kept displacing the mortar from the brick.
Sally's project revealed itself first with a primitive sketch on a napkin, and shortly after that, with a delivery of rocks deposited in the driveway. After that, he began, one stone at a time, building a wall along the front perimeter of their small patch of lawn. Ginger fretted about her mother's reaction. But when Glory came home from work and saw what he'd started, all she did was cross her arms and say,
"Why so piddly, Sally? Why not bigger rocks?"
From which Ginger deduced the project had already been approved. Once the base was finished, and work on the upper wall began, Ginger wondered if her mother actually saw the wall at all, because surely if she did, she would have made him stop. Instead, she let him go on, and so, legs astride the metal folding chair he'd dragged to the sidewalk, Sally continued cementing stones, one atop the other, into narrow, jagged peaks that from a distance looked like piles of dripping sand. It was summer, 2 years after the accident, when Sally called everyone into the den to watch the evening news. Ginger was the only one who came. She made herself comfortable on the floor, leaning against her father's chair as Walter Cronkite spoke to the nation.
"Good evening. President Nixon will announce his resignation tonight, and Vice President Ford will become the nation's 38th president tomorrow. Get your mother."
Ginger found her mother in bed, journal on lap, pen in her mouth, thinking.
"Mom is busy," Ginger reported after Glory shooed her away. "She'll come soon."
Sally nodded. Although Ginger had never heard him say a single nice word about the president, it was clear from his pallor this resignation was a big deal. She lay on her stomach, head resting in the V of her hands, and watched as Dan Rather continued the report.
"According to his staff, unless the president has a sudden change of head and heart..." "Tell your mother she has to come now," Sally said.
Her mother was on the phone, but Ginger pressed her father's case.
"He said, you have to come. The president is resigning."
Glory cupped her free ear, which Ginger understood meant,
"Stop interrupting and leave me alone."
"She'll be here in a minute,"
Ginger lied. She returned to her position on the floor and noted how grim Dan Rather looked as he shared the news.
"On a Potomac cruise aboard the yacht Sequoia, his daughters urged him not to do it. He agreed to reconsider."
"Will he?"
Ginger liked the idea of a president who listened to his daughters.
"As of this hour," Dan Rather answered her, "he has not changed his mind."
Suddenly, this was all Ginger wanted, for the President of the United States to change his mind because of his daughters.
"Do you think he might change his mind?"
Her father grunted a reply, which Ginger understood meant,
"Shh, I'm trying to hear." "Last night," Dan Rather continued, "at a family dinner upstairs in the White House, some of the family was in tears."
It was almost impossible to imagine. The family of the President of the United States in tears.
"Does he mean watery eyes or actual tears going down their cheeks?"
This time when her father didn't answer, she turned around. She noticed right away that his eyes were unfocused, but it took several moments for her brain to sort out the rest. As the medics lifted Sally's body onto the stretcher, Richard Nixon declared,
"I have never been a quitter."
As they carried Sally out of the den, Richard Nixon said,
"In passing this office to the Vice President, I do so with a profound sense of the weight of responsibility that will fall on his shoulders tomorrow."
"He fainted, that's all,"
Glory insisted, and the President said,
"As he assumes that responsibility, he will deserve the help and the support of all of us."
When the medics finally got her to understand her husband was dead, Glory's knees buckled. They offered to take her to the hospital, but she declined, so they helped her to the couch. There was much clattering. First, the gurney's wheels got stuck on the molding in the threshold of the den, and after that, it banged into the wall in the narrow front hall. But finally,
Solly Tangle's corpse left the house. Without being asked, Ginger went to the kitchen and filled a bowl with ice water. She came back and placed a cool washcloth on her mother's pale forehead.
"Heal the wounds,"
Nixon said as Glory stood up, letting the washcloth fall to the floor.
"Put the bitterness behind us,"
he beseeched the American people as she headed for the stairs.
"Rediscover those shared ideals,"
the president implored, as Mimi and Callie called from the kitchen where they'd been hiding.
"Is it safe to come out?"
"Yes," Ginger told them. They sat together, three sisters huddled close, crying freely, as Richard Nixon promised the return of their strength and their unity as a great and free people. Later that night, Ginger considered calling Evelyn, because surely Evelyn would want to know. But though Evelyn had promised she'd write, she never did. And Ginger, who had no idea how to go about looking for someone, knew better than to ask. At the funeral, she met many people she'd never heard of and a few she rarely saw. From her father's side, there was Clara, his sister who lived in Chicago. Clara was the one who sent dollar bills and birthday cards every year, the one they had to call to say thank you, which was awkward. There were also the cousins who lived on Long Island, who felt so terrible they never visited that Ginger ended up comforting them. From her mother's side, there was only one person, Glory's Aunt Ida, a tall, thin woman who sat by herself for the entire funeral, with a look of such terror on her face, no one came near her. By the time they got home from the cemetery, one more chair had been removed from the kitchen table, though by whom, Ginger had no idea. Glory did not wallow. At the end of her first week as a widow, she went back to work. The sisters did their part, trying not to look too sad in front of her, and also not to look too happy. But at night, when they were alone in their room, one or the other, and sometimes all three, would slide under the covers to muffle the sound of their sorrow. In September, Glory surprised them by announcing Callie was not changing schools after all. This came after a long meeting with Miss Mackerel, the guidance counselor prison guard who Glory succeeded in turning into an ally. Ginger suspected this had something to do with her father's death. The latest sad event seemed to change how Callie was seen, from being a problem child to being a girl in need of rescue. Accommodations were made, a kind teacher selected, class friendships socially engineered. None of it worked. Callie continued to leave school in the middle of the day, two or three times a week. By January, Ginger, Callie's self-appointed search and rescuer, was labeled a chronic cutter. The punishment was afternoon detention. This presented a problem. If Ginger wasn't home after school to distract her, Callie would roam the neighborhood, no matter the weather. Ginger solved the problem when she realized no one got detention for staying home sick. The first few times she faked it, but after a while her stomach cramps felt real. Glory had no idea Ginger was playing sick, but she did notice she wasn't eating much and cautioned her to watch it.
Gaunt cheeks are not becoming on a long face.
Soon after that, Mimi joined in, the two sisters working out a schedule of alternating sick days so that one of them could always be on watch for Callie. It didn't take long for Miss Mackerel to figure out their scheme. The consequences were swift.
"You heard me,"
Glory paced back and forth in the small den.
"You're over the limit on absences. You have to repeat the year. All of you."
The girls stared into their laps.
"Warden Mackerel says you're bad for each other. Says I should split you up. I asked her which one of you she wants to adopt, but she wasn't amused. As if one girl in trouble wasn't enough. Now I got an epidemic on my hands."
She went on to rail about Mr. Freeze, who'd blown his top when she told him she had to miss work for another school meeting. Ginger wasn't sure which problem was upsetting her more. Her mother's solution was to ask Mr. Freeze if she could go back to working part-time. But her former champion was no longer interested in making accommodations for her chaotic home life. These were tough days, he told her. Newark stores were shutting down. Widow or no widow,